getting the creature's attention. Just as the Rothacrit was prepared to smash into the warthog, which Mike had clambered atop, it whipped its massive, tooth-filled face around and glared in Kasha's direction, only a few hundred meters away. It snarled as if the sound she'd made had pierced its head and was burrowing its way into the beast's brain. "We should get back to the transport. Right now," Karim said, his eyes fixed on Kasha and the beast. He didn't sound too urgent about it, so the rest of the group ignored him. Somewhere behind them, a few of the students in the vehicle were screaming. Kasha moved off to the right, toward an open set of hangar doors, as the Rothacrit edged in her direction and replanted its legs. She clearly didn't want the beast to charge at her and then run headlong into the transport if she could help it. As Kasha angled away from a straight line between their group and the Rothacrit, the monster tracked her with its head for a moment. When it felt the time had come for it to attack, it launched itself away from Mike and toward Kasha. The Sangheili headmaster spun on her heels and ran. She burst out of the hangar at a speed that shocked Molly and launched out into the open fields on the far side of the repository. The Rothacrit chased after her, moving incredibly fast. Its agility was more like that of a hunting cat than something the size of a maglev train, and it seemed only to pick up steam as it went. "It's going to get her," Gadam said as the beast bore down on Kasha. "We have to stop it!" Molly put a hand on Gadam's shoulder to keep her where she was. All that chasing after Kasha would have done for the little Ungoy was to add another casualty to the list. Molly respected Gadam's grit and bravery, despite her diminutive size, but that would do no one any good. And Molly also was growing fond of the alien. While the monster charged, Kasha kept blasting out more whistles the entire way. The creature closed the distance, and the Rothacrit's shadow began blotting out the sun over the headmaster, the two running at full tilt. Then the Sangheili skidded to a halt. For an agonizing moment, the four of them watched as the Rothacrit reared up on its four hind legs, still charging forward, preparing to pounce in one single blow. Its toothy mouth opening wide, it looked as if it might be able to swallow Kasha whole, along with the ground on which she stood. As the beast brought its ferocious maw down to strike, Kasha dove to her left, completely out of Molly's field of view. Gadam let out a loud squeal of terror. The Rothacrit turned its head to see what had made the noise. Its face smashed into the ground, losing the headmaster and driving its body headlong, forcing a spray of grass and dirt into the air. Molly spotted Kasha on the far side of the beast, darting away. She had tumbled clear in time. As the creature got its bearings, its head snapped around to focus on the fleeing Sangheili. Kasha was favoring her left leg just a bit. She'd been injured in some way. While she had been able to avoid the Rothacrit's attack once, it wouldn't happen again. Back behind the group in the hangar, Molly could hear Mike fighting to start the warthog, but the vehicle's system seemed to refuse to comply. Molly wondered if they'd been put on security lockdown, given the creature's rampage. To her, it didn't seem as if any help would be coming from that quarter, at least not right away. "Do that again," Bakar said to Gadam. "What?" The young goy was still gaping at the sight of the Rothacrit clawing itself up out of the little crater it had made in its first assault, and then charging toward Kasha. Molly instantly figured out Bakar's plan. It was stupid, insane, and dangerous as hell, but too much was at stake with no time to argue. She grabbed Gadam by the shoulders, looking intently into the creature's beady eyes, and said, "He means squeal, just like you did before, but louder." Gadam goggled at Molly, seriously shaken. Molly shouted at her even louder. "Do it! No!" The little Ungoy let out an ear-splitting shriek at a much higher frequency and volume than before. If any glass had been nearby, Molly had little doubt that it would have completely shattered. Molly looked over at the Rothacrit, which had been rushing toward Kasha again. The animal stopped dead in its tracks and held its position for a long moment, shaking its head at the intensity of Gadam's voice. Then the beast let out a shuddering roar that seemed to shake the sky. Both Gadam and Molly stood there stunned, but Kareem grabbed their hands and hauled them away. He sprinted straight past the transport, out into the open, but in the opposite direction of the Rafikrit. Molly couldn't see it, but she knew the Rafikrit was readying to charge their position. Molly didn't think. She just followed at full speed. It was all she could do to keep up with Kareem. Gadam couldn't even manage that. Her legs were too short and her waddling gait slowed her down even more. Bakar sprinted up from behind the three and scooped the young goy up into his big arms. She squealed again in surprise, which produced another gut-wrenching roar from the Rafikrit. As the ground began to rumble beneath their feet, there was no question about who it was coming after now. But the sound from the beast's trampling feet only spurred them all on faster. The question was, how far can we get before it reaches us? Molly looked back, and then immediately regretted doing so. The creature was pursuing the four of them at full speed, its eyes locked onto their position. Kasha had stopped in the far distance, turning to gape at them as they scrambled across the open ground on one side of the facility's outskirts. Molly realized now that the tree line nearly 100 meters ahead was too far. She searched around for something closer to hide behind. A tree, a boulder, anything. But on this side of the repository, all that lay before them was open ground. They would not make it to the forest in time, and even if they did, it held no guarantee of safety. The beast was closing on the four of them fast and would be on top of them in seconds. Molly only hoped that Kasha had figured out what they were trying to do and had a solution in hand. Meanwhile, the Rafikrit had drawn so close to them, Molly could feel its hot breath on the back of her neck. Molly was bringing up the rear, with Kareem just a bit ahead of her. Even with Gadam in his arms, Bakar could outpace all of them. The Rafikrit would get to Molly first. There was no question about it. She gritted her teeth tight and kept sprinting, feeling its thundering footsteps pounding into the ground. As the beast's wide shadow descended to pluck Molly from the ground, Kasha's high-pitched whistle rang out again. Once more, the Rafikrit skidded to a halt, then took off back toward Kasha. The resultant spray of dirt and grass rippled along the ground at Molly's feet and sent her flying to the side. She tumbled to a stop on the turf, spinning to see the beast as it charged away from them, once more unleashing a bone-rattling roar.
"I can't believe that worked," Kareem said, as he came up behind Molly, completely out of breath.
Bakar set Gadam down beside Molly and let out a deep sigh himself. "You do realize the worst part of all this? Other than being chased down by a monster and almost devoured?" Molly asked. He nodded. "The stories of the Rafikrit said that whistling would drive it away." Gadam shook her head.
"Whoever came up with that story was trying to kill you all."
Molly pointed at Kasha, who was now racing back toward the repository at top speed, her injury showing more with every step.
"Where is Kasha drawing that thing now?" Molly asked.
Bakar gestured toward the repository. "I think Mr. Spencer has an answer for that." The warthog appeared in one of the open hangar doors with Mike at the wheel. He punched the vehicle past the transport and brought it right to the edge of the repository. There he stopped the machine, jumped out of the driver's seat, and clambered over the roll cage for the Gauss cannon mounted on the warthog's bed. The Rafikrit hadn't noticed Mike yet, but was catching up with Kasha fast. It was only seconds from overtaking her. Molly turned to Gadam, but she had already cupped her hands around her mouth. The young goy let loose another loud and piercing shriek. This time Molly covered her ears, for all the good that seemed to do. She worried that the Rafikrit might have gotten too far away to hear Gadam's cry. But the thing once again halted, reared up its head, and shot a cold look in their direction. Just as it did, Mike opened up with the Gauss cannon and stitched a line of gigantic ferric tungsten rounds into the monster's flank. The impact was more violent than Molly had expected. The Rafikrit howled in pain as the alloy slugs punched holes into its torso. Its awful death throes sounded unlike anything Molly had ever heard.
Despite its injuries, the animal wrenched itself around on its hind legs and attempted to charge the warthog. Mike was no fool. He unleashed another volley of rounds, this time directly into the Rafikrit's face. In seconds, the beast toppled over onto its side, its massive form falling limp to the ground, the fight completely drained from its body. Mike blasted it three more times for safe measure. Molly didn't like to watch anything die, but she made an exception for that thing. She had no remorse about seeing the animal expire, even if it had been the last one on Onyx. It had almost killed her and her friends. Friends, she thought. Are we friends? Then she looked behind her and realized whom she had just survived alongside. A human, an Ungoy, and a Sangheili. The three stood with weary faces and eyes wide, staring at the lifeless monster in the distance. They had survived together. A bunch of outsiders. If that didn't make them friends, Molly wasn't sure what would. Chapter 17. With even Keel's help, the servants of the Abiding Truth now had access to many places inside the shield world, and Dural meant to make that advantage work for them. To that end, the Huragok had begun a slow and methodical categorization of the places they could effectively reach by means of their base's portal system. It was astonishing how versatile the system was, and how far it could take them. Dural's advanced strike forces had found themselves scouting many strange lands populated by all manner of creatures. But their methodology of exploration had not been an exact science. Even Keel noted that much of this world's portal network was either incomplete or malfunctioning. The Huragok claimed that they could pass undetected for a time, but eventually others on this world would be sure to notice them making use of the system. If they did, so be it. The servants of the Abiding Truth would be ready. While they had the wind to their back and relatively unfettered access to Onyx's portal network, they should exploit it. Some of these lands, such as the region from which the Rafikrits came, had stronger gravity, and the sun shone with a diminished light. Other regions had lesser gravity, and their skies were sometimes filled with creatures far too large to take flight on most other worlds, such as Dural's own. Some were overflowing with mountains, while others seemed to feature nothing but endless seas. And others had both, with mountains that floated like islands in the sky, among vast oceans of dense clouds. There seemed to be no end to the variety of places Onyx was comprised of. A thought staggering at first, yet almost dreadful if pondered too deeply. But by this method, the servants had soon discovered the other Huragok and its location, the repository. Dural decided to travel there personally to reconnoiter it, not trusting anyone else to give him the details he needed to create the right strategy. The portal leading into the repository opened into a gigantic hangar, filled with a vast panoply of craft, many of which he could take cover behind. The pale blade used his modified armor's active camouflage to help ensure that he would not be seen. Due to his armor's power requirements, Dural could only bend light around himself for a handful of seconds at a time. But that proved more than sufficient for his purposes. Once inside the repository, he carefully prowled the outskirts of the hangar's interior, clinging to the shadows. Some of the vehicles in the repository were spaceworthy, while others were designed for use on the ground. They included designs from all over, Covenant, Forerunner, and Human too. Dural recognized that this absurd menagerie of firepower, if leveraged properly by the servants, could easily give them a distinct advantage in the coming days. He was not as concerned then about such weaponry, though, as he was about the second Huragok. That was the real prize. One thing was clear to him. Engineers were the currency of the gods on a world filled to the brim with Forerunner technology. If the servants had any hope for victory, they needed to secure as many of the engineers as they could, as fast as possible. People milled about the repository, which meant Durell could not simply track down and secure the Huragok at will. Most of them were human researchers and even soldiers in uniforms of the human government. But shockingly, some disloyal Ungoy were present as well, and beyond all reason, he also spied a number of Sangheili working alongside the servants' foes. At first, Durell thought perhaps the Sangheili had been captured, much like his father, and then simply forced into labor on this world. That would be utterly shameful, but at least not treasonous. The dishonor would have been forced upon them, rather than suffered as the result of their own willful perversion. After watching them in secret, though, it became clear they were not prisoners. For one, they wore no variety of shackles. But what revealed the truth was when Durell spied one of them issuing requests to some of the humans. The humans obeyed, and not in the fearful way a warrior might respond to an officer's orders, but in the manner of colleagues. They were allies. Durell knew that the Arbiter had sent his own people here and that they were working closely with the humans. But to see it firsthand. He cursed those traitorous Sangheili under his breath, but he could do little to take vengeance on them and their Ungoy servants then, not without giving away his presence and missing the opportunity to procure the engineer. Avumed Telkam had once worked directly with humans as a means to an end. He sought to dethrone the Arbiter and all unbelievers on Sanghelios, no matter the cost. But Telkam had seen clearly that Sangheili rule could only be realized through Sangheili power alone. Durell knew that Telkam's plan, once the servants had finally defeated the Arbiter, would be to turn the blade on the human vermin they had worked with, and ultimately finish what the prophets had started. This, though, felt different. The Arbiter's people and his human compatriots worked together here to propagate their own vile agenda of compromise. It was so infuriating for Durell that he had to satisfy his indignation by swearing to himself that all the Sangheili traitors he saw on this world would die at his hands soon enough. After a long while stalking about the shadows of the repository, Durell spotted a Huragok working there as well, confirming the claims that even Keel had made. This engineer had a number of people escorting it, however, and it never seemed to be alone. To be able to safely take the creature, Durell would need a distraction. He already had an excellent one at hand. Returning to the cathedral, the Pale Blade set his plan into motion, gathering a strike team of his best warriors about him, the same who had accompanied him in the vanguard when they first entered Onyx. With these chosen few at his side, Durell had Keel open the portal to the location where they knew the Ruffakreet roamed. Burren had been the first to identify the creatures that had attacked the humans on the servant's first night in Onyx. It was an ancient fledgling story beast that his mother had warned him about. Or at least something that looked like one. Durell's mother had not been much for retelling sad fables. Perhaps she had noticed that he did not care for such things. But such stories were certainly kept on scrolls in the archives of Bacon Keep. They had been more to Asim's liking than Durell's. To think that such a monster from an old tale could be brought to life, Rook had said. This must truly be the playground of the gods. Do you really think the Forerunners somehow conjured up creatures from Sangheili fables? Burren said. It is far more likely that they discovered such creatures and simply brought them here, much as we might keep specimens for observation or entertainment. Doubtless, the stories had originated on another Sangheili world where these creatures once lived. How then do you explain their presence here? Why would the gods bring such creatures to this world? Rook huffed at this. You can cling to your outlandish beliefs, Burhan, and I will cling to mine. Duron let them bicker with each other over meaningless distinctions, while he got to work. Using the bravest of his warriors as bait, he eventually drew one of the creatures off from its fellows, and lured it back toward the portal. This proved simple, as the creatures hadn't moved that far off from where they had attacked the humans. Having tasted blood there already, they seemed to consider the place to be a fine hunting ground. All the warriors had to do was drive the monster through the portal and into the repository. Fortuitously, both portals were large enough for this creature, a clear indicator that the gods had foreseen and blessed Tural's plan. Unfortunately, convincing the creature to pass through the portal proved a challenge. As the Rathakreet lumbered toward the portal, the warrior it had been following disappeared before its eyes. Mystified, the beast did not charge forward after its vanished prey. Instead, it spun about and took out its frustration on the rest of the warriors who had gathered nearby to speed into the repository soon after the creature emerged there. The beast snapped out with its jaws faster than Dural would have thought possible, and its teeth closed around one of his brethren. Its jaws shaking back and forth, the beast tore the hapless Sangheili to shreds. Another of Dural's warriors, perhaps thinking to display his honor, leaped forward to try to save what remained of the first, but it was already far too late. When the second warrior lunged forward, the Rathakreet dropped its first victim and struck out at the would-be rescuer with its foreclaw. This fell blow was even more decisive, killing that warrior instantly by snapping his spine. The beast savaged the fallen Sangheili while two of Dural's other warriors darted behind it, in an effort to snatch their first wounded compatriot from the fray. Dural could see the injured warrior had lost a tremendous amount of blood, and would soon succumb to his wounds. One of his saviors had clamped a hand over his mandibles so that his groans of agony, which were shameful from the mouth of any Sangheili, would not draw the beast toward them. Despite that, the Rathakreet would soon be done with its current meal, and Dural had to make a quick decision. He got the attention of the two warriors holding down their dying fellow, whose thrashing had already begun to weaken. "Throw him at the foot of the portal," the Pale Blade ordered. They both gaped at him, their mandibles hanging loose in surprise. "Are you mad?" Burhan said. "He is an honored warrior and should be dispatched with the dignity he deserves." Dural snarled at the older Sangheili, daring Burhan to get into his teeth about this. He did not have the time to debate this. He was a fool, but his death may still prove useful. Dural glared at the two warriors holding the dying Sangheili down. "What are you waiting for? Throw him at the foot of the portal, and keep his mouth uncovered as you do." This warrior had certainly failed the gods by allowing the beast to have its way with him. Despite that fatal mistake, perhaps he could now atone for his sin. The two warriors dashed toward the portal, towing their dying brethren between them. As they moved, the Rathakreet raised its bloodied face and stared after them, evidently trying to decide whether it should abandon its current dinner for an even fresher one. As ordered, the two warriors stopped just before the portal and uncovered the mouth of their mortally wounded compatriot. The dying warrior released a howl of agony, which drew the beast's interest. Acting in tandem, the two threw the Sangheili at the portal's very edge, where he lay on the verge of being drawn into the swirl of energy. The Rathakreet had already begun charging toward the trio, and the two who had carried the Sangheili dove to the sides, attempting to remove themselves from the creature's sight. The beast bore down directly toward the dying Sangheili. It collided with its prey so fast that its inertia carried them both into the portal, and they vanished from sight. Dural held up a hand to signal the others to wait. It will not be long. The creature should wreak havoc quickly. He retrieved his carbine from its mount on his back. Let the weaklings there mount a defense against it. Then, while the beast has their attention, we strike. After several long moments, the pale blade made for the portal, motioning for the others to follow him. The entire band of warriors fell right in line with no griping, not even from Rook or Burren. On the other side of the portal, they emerged on the edge of chaos. The team of servants quickly found the remains of their fallen warrior abandoned just past the portal's mouth. From the blood splattered everywhere, it seemed he had acquitted himself well in his final moments. The trail of blood continued on into the vast interior of the repository, and now Dural could hear weapons firing, both human and Sangheili. He spotted the creature deep inside the hangar, its back to them as it hurled its bulk into a phantom, causing the dropship to crumple under its assault. His strike team moved toward it, keeping out of sight as best they could. Dural scanned the carnage the creature had left in its wake. The beast had quickly slaughtered several personnel, including two of the Sangheili traitors. While Dural relished their deaths, they felt unsatisfying, as he had not personally brought justice to them with his own hands. The servants moved along the hangar's back wall, doing their best to keep low and out of sight. They did not want the monster to somehow spot them and bring undue attention to them, or worse, decide that they would make an easier kill than whomever it was trying to reach behind the phantom. Dural ran his eyes across the interior of the structure, looking for the one Huragok he knew worked in the repository, but it was nowhere to be seen. He then signaled the others to be silent, and they slipped deeper into the hangar, keeping to the shadows, far out of sight of the fracas the monster was causing. If they needed to reveal themselves, it would be to grab the Huragok, not because they were forced to confront the monster. The Rafakrit kept bashing into the phantom and even tried to sink its teeth into the dropship's armor. If the craft had been small enough for it to wrap its jaws around the front end, Dural had little doubt the monster would have succeeded. As his team neared the far end of the hangar and lost the mythical animal behind the array of seemingly endless vehicles, a high-pitched whistle sounded from somewhere outside the hangar, and the Rafakrit suddenly bolted off after it. A gray-haired human appeared from behind a wraith roughly 100 meters away. The vehicle had been violently mauled by the Rafakrit only moments before. Dural doubted its operability. Rather than use the wraith, however, the human raced over to an all-terrain vehicle his species called a warthog, a graceless wheeled machine that looked equal parts crude and vulgar, and he struggled to get it started. The human was far too concerned with the Rafakrit to see the servants skulking in the shadows so far behind him. Dural momentarily considered shooting him with his carbine, but they were there to find the Huragok, not to kill humans. There would be plenty of time for that later. With a few silent hand motions, Dural told Rook and the others to fan out and search for the Huragok. "Take it and run for the portal," Dural whispered to them, not daring to be misunderstood. "At any cost, nothing else matters." As they moved to execute his orders, he kept one eye on the man in the warthog and another on the Rafakrit, which remained outside. If the man dealt with the beast's rampage soon, they would have to retreat before he discovered them as well. Dural peered over the nose of a nearby banshee. In the far distance, the creature was chasing someone down in the rolling field just outside the hangar. He shaded his eyes to peer closer, and saw that it was barreling toward a Sangheili. A female, no less. He had to fight the immediate urge to commandeer one of the nearby craft and rush to save her, the way any honorable Sangheili warrior had been taught to do. Yet if she was here with the humans, she was likely as much a traitor as the others he had seen working in the hangar, no doubt a deceived thrall of the Arbiter's, sent to promulgate his compromised view of Sangheili's sovereignty. Dural had no desire to risk his life for such treason. Still he winced as the beast ran her to ground. She reminded him of the fate of his mother, a female inexplicably drawn out of her keep and murdered by forces far beyond her control. Dural offered a quick prayer to the Forerunners, that this other female might at least suffer a quick death. Then he heard a squeal from beyond the warthog and moved to his left to get a better view. From there, Dural spotted a large human transport parked just outside one of the hangar's open doors, but he couldn't see the source of the sound. There was some commotion about the vehicle, but his vantage was so obscured that he returned his attention to the creature's pursuit. The Rafikrit launched itself at the Sangheili female. She dove out of its path at the last possible instant, and the creature's jaws crashed into the turf instead, sending up a spray of dirt. As she limped away from the monster, something near the transport squealed yet again, even louder this time, like a stuck kolo beast. Dural turned to see three figures race away from the transport, and the Rafikrit went after them. Two of them were human, and they had an ungoy with them. They appeared to be mere children, which shocked him. Then he saw a young Sangheili male chase close behind. At first, Dural thought the Sangheili was attempting to attack the others, but that proved to be only wishful thinking. Instead, the young Sangheili scooped up the ungoy and carried it as the four tried to evade the monster, which was quickly gaining on their position. Dural realized something stunning as his gaze hung on the Sangheili. At first, he thought that he recognized the Sangheili from some indeterminate time in the past. It wasn't just the peculiar shade of the Sangheili's skin, but also the way he moved. It was all too familiar. And then Dural realized who it was. How can that possibly be? Just as it seemed as if the Rafikrit might catch the four racing away from it, the Sangheili female blasted out yet another whistle and drew the creature back toward her. Dural saw their plan now, and he admired it for its simplicity, if not its wisdom. They would tire the creature out by calling it back and forth between their two positions. That would only last for so long, however. Once it got bored of playing games, it would simply finish them off. But then the struggling engine of the warthog finally came to life. The wheeled machine lurched forward, with the gray-haired human operating it. The vehicle accelerated quickly until it reached the end of the pavement that surrounded the repository. And then it came to a dead stop. The human jumped out of his seat and took up the position of the rear gunner, taking control of some kind of magnetic device mounted there. Dural had seen this powerful but primitive weapon in operation once before. The cannon barked metal death at the monster until it stopped moving. Dural found himself unconcerned by the Rafikrit's death, though he knew it affected his plan. Seeing that traitorous Sangheili save those two young humans, along with the ungoy in his arms, drove Dural into a righteous fury. For a moment he lost sight of his objective, so desperate was he to vindicate the honor of his people. That scum had betrayed Dural, his keep, and his entire species. Dural wanted nothing more than to race out onto the field and take him down with one fell swoop. Perhaps he would allow the traitor to explain first what could have possibly led him down such a shameful path. Then Dural would kill him, regardless of any explanation, if only to restore honor to Bacon Keep. As Dural glared at the betrayer, he heard something off to his left, in the far corner of the hangar. It was the telltale sound of plasma bursts, followed by an agonized scream. Have my warriors finally found their prey? Dural hesitated, struggling against his rage so as to move, his eyes fixed on the pale Sangheili in the distance. But the sounds of the battle so increased that he could no longer ignore them. Dural spun to his left, but before he could advance more than a few paces, he spotted Burren backing toward him from that direction. "We found the Hurrigach," the old warrior shouted. "A group of cowards barricaded themselves and it inside a room, and we are attempting to blast through the door." Dural's heart pounded in triumph, but his sense of victory proved short-lived. He could now hear the sound of human aircraft overhead, and knew that the servants had run out of time. Part of him seethed at his own preoccupation with the events that had played out in the hangar, while another remained furious at the incompetence of those in his charge. "Fools," he shouted at Burren. "They have called in reinforcements. We cannot stand against them." Burren stared up at the roof of the hangar, as if the human craft might smash right through it and begin pouring fire on them. "What shall we do?" "We fall back. Issue the order to the rest of the servants. Fall back to the portal, now!" The others came running at the sound of his voice, and he stood his ground, waving each of them past as they came. Once Dural accounted for them all, he sprinted after the last one, Rook, cursing at them to move faster. As the servants reached the portal, a human gunship they called a Pelican appeared at the side of the hangar, dropping low to the ground. Then it spun up its guns. "Run!" Dural shouted. Bullets tore through the repository's interior, piercing the air and blistering the walls around them as they dashed through the doorway of light. Dural felt rounds narrowly scrape the shoulders of his armor as he left the repository behind. "Close it!" he shouted at Evenkeel, who hovered next to a pair of warriors Dural had left to guard it. "Seal the portal shut, now!" The Hurrigach reached toward a small terminal at its side, and touched a glowing symbol carved into its stony surface. With a ghostly whirl of energy, the portal immediately ceased to be. An unimaginable rage filled Dural as he stared back at the empty doorway. Not only had they failed to procure a second Hurrigach, but they had alerted the humans and their faceless allies to the servants' presence on Onyx. Even graver than all that was the traitor he had seen. That revelation alone was enough to force Dural to reconsider everything. To think that he had found him here, after years of searching for him across Bacon and the back country of M'Dama, and indeed all of Sangheili, and to see him working with humans. Dural wondered how such a thing could be true. Dural wanted nothing more than to track him down and tear him into tiny, painful pieces. He roared in agonized, frustrated dismay. "Asim, my brother, what have you done?" Chapter 18. After Mike Spencer brought the Rafikrit down, Kasha hobbled over to join Molly, Karim, Gudam, and Bakar. Once they caught their breath, the headmaster insisted they get back into the transport right away. She thanked them for their help, but apparently they weren't out of the clear yet. Some shots had been fired within the repository, even after the creature had left it. The danger might not be over after all. None of them argued. They'd had their fill of adventure for the day. A Pelican full of marines soared in from Trevelyan, coming to a quick stop above the repository as the four youths trotted toward the transport. The dropship lowered to the ground, pivoting around to dispatch troops from its rear bay. Then it swung around to the far side of the hangar and began unloading its weapons at whatever was in the rear of the repository. Mike snapped the four a quick salute and then ran over to meet the marines and direct their efforts as they edged toward the repository's main entrance. The four entered the transport and took the same seats they'd had before. The other students in the transport didn't say much to them. They just gaped. Molly was content with that response.
She was in too much shock to talk at the moment, still trying to process what had just happened. The release of the adrenaline that had been coursing through her body left her trembling, and Kareem was clearly feeling the same effects, because his hands were shaking intensely. Bakar seemed steady as a rock, however, maybe even more pensive than before. Perhaps most shocking of all, Ghadam had fallen completely silent. Not a single student spoke for the entire trip home. When they finally reached the Pax Institute, their whole class gathered in the dining hall, most of them speaking only in hushed tones. Kasha conferred with Director Mendez, who'd met Molly and the others at the door, having his personnel check off all of their names on a slate as they entered the building. The entire class was to be sent home. While Kasha helped dismiss the other students, Director Mendez came over to Molly, Kareem, Ghadam, and Bakar, and stood at the end of their table, resting his stern eyes on them. "You're brave, lucky fools." He crossed his arms. "I know Headmaster Hylot has already expressed her gratitude to you for saving her life, and allow me to echo that." "For someone thanking us, you don't seem all that pleased," Kareem said. "I'm not." Director Mendez gave them each a hard look. "You should have followed the headmaster's orders and gotten into the transport with the other kids. You made a stupid mistake."
"But wouldn't that have gotten her killed?" said Ghadam. "From where we were standing, it looked like the creature was going to run her down and chomp her to bits. If we hadn't been able to distract the monster, she would have died, right?"
"Sometimes soldiers die in war," Director Mendez said. "If they're fortunate, they get to do that so the rest of us get to live."
"But she's not a soldier," Molly pointed out. "She's our headmaster."
"And we are not at war," said Bakar.
Director Mendez gave them a wry, faint smile.
"Fair enough. Old habits die hard. Still, when your headmaster gives you an order, you follow it. Understood?"
The four all solemnly nodded at him.
"Fine."
Tom and Lucy walked into the room wearing their black mesh tech suits with rifles slung on their backs, and Director Mendez motioned for them to join the group. They saluted him as they approached.
"Belay that," he said. "I'm retired."
"You're still our boss, Chief," said Tom. Director Mendez gave him a sour look and then gestured toward the kids. "I have a group of heroes here who helped save Headmaster Hylot and Mr. Spencer. Please get them back to their homes so they don't get killed doing any other foolish stunts on the way." Then he looked at Bakar. "All except for you." Bakar cocked his head at Director Mendez, curious.
"Why is that?"
"For one, there's no one waiting for you at home. Headmaster Hylot will be busy here for the rest of the day.
There are other adults at the Pax Keep."
"You have a keep here?" Molly asked. Bakar shrugged at her.
"That is how Sangheili live, in keeps."
Director Mendez cut off their conversation. "None of them are liable to be as understanding of your situation as Headmaster Hylot."
"What situation?"
Director Mendez shot Tom a look. The Spartan stepped forward and spoke to Bakar.
"We have some information that we need to discuss with you before you leave the school." "We can do that here, now. Then can I leave?"
Molly wasn't good at reading Sangheili, but Bakar seemed even more frustrated than normal. After the day they'd had, Molly wasn't surprised. Tom raised a questioning eyebrow at Director Mendez, who gave him a go-ahead nod. The Spartan first looked around to make sure no one was listening, then intently focused on the four of them.
"This can go no further. Understood?"
They all nodded in agreement. Tom turned to Bakar again. "Did you hear about the battle in the hangar at the repository?" The Sangheili shook his head, uncertain.
"Kasha mentioned something about shots fired."
Tom nodded. "The animal that Spencer brought down today shouldn't have been able to get past the outer barrier, much less all the way into the repository's district. not without setting off the alarm relays. Someone used a portal to bring the animal there. A portal that's been inactive for years.
Why would anyone in Onyx do that? Kareem asked.
It wasn't any of our folks. Tom squared up to the group. The team that works in the repository followed protocol to the T when the animal was first spotted. Priority one was to ensure the Huragok on the premises was secured. That's their primary directive. We can't have such a valuable asset falling into the wrong hands. However, a group of armed Sangheili warriors attempted to extract the Huragok from the control room inside the repository. They managed to break through the first door and take down someone from the research team. But when our reinforcements arrived via Pelican, they fled. They escaped back through the portal and shut it down from the other side. Bakar opened all his jaws in surprise.
The researcher. Will he survive?
Lucy gave him a grim nod.
He's not in good shape, but he should be all right.
Tom continued. We checked the security cameras we've got networked across the repository. We captured good images of each of the attackers. From the markings on their armor alone, it's obvious who they were. It's a faction called the Servants of the Abiding Truth. An organization dedicated to...
I know who they are,
Bakar responded flatly. Of course you do.
Are they here for me?
We have no reason to suspect they were originally after you. Their target seems to have been the Huragok working at the repository. Fortunately, our reinforcements drove them off before they could acquire him.
Wait, Molly said, confused and more than a little suspicious. Why would they be after Bakar?
Tom kept his eyes fixed on the Sangheili. We can do this somewhere more private. Bakar looked at the others and considered his options.
No, they can hear.
Mendez glanced around once again to make sure they were alone. The rest of the dining hall had long since emptied out.
This is top secret.
He leveled his fierce gaze at each of them. We only know about it ourselves because young Bakar here came clean with us about his past during the vetting process. It cannot go any further than this.
Understood.
The three of them nodded in agreement. I need to hear you say it.
Yes, Molly, Kareem, and Gudam all said. We understand.
Mendez gestured at Bakar. The Sangheili wrenched up his jaws for a moment, as if he'd swallowed something bitter. Then he spat it out.
I was not born Bakar. My real name is Asim Mdama.
Molly cocked her head at him. She knew he was trying to be honest, but the Sangheili name he gave meant nothing to her. At least, not initially. Then, searching her memory, she realized something and said, I've heard that last name before. The pieces clicked into place.
Jewel Mdama?
Who?
Asked Gudam. He's the leader of the largest remaining vestige of the Covenant still left fighting, Kareem said.
So?
Gudam said, unsure where this was headed. I grew up in Bacon Keep of the city-state Mdama, where Jewel was our Kaidan, Bakar said. Jewel Mdama is my uncle, my family, and my blood. Molly gasped at this. Bakar bowed his head. One half of Molly wanted to hit him. The other wanted to scream at him. Then she just wanted to throw up. Bakar's uncle was a mass murderer. Gudam put a hand on Bakar's leg.
It's okay. Lots of people's family members did terrible things during the war. In fact, my great-grandfather personally destroyed a human ship on Harvest. Of course, he blew himself up along with it. But that's how it goes. No one holds me responsible for that, right?
No one responded for a moment. She gazed up at the rest of them with suddenly worried eyes.
Right?
Of course not, Kareem said. That was before any of us were born. The war may be over, but we're still dealing with the aftermath, Director Mendez said. One of the reasons we established the Pax Institute was so we could start to heal the wounds the war caused. Some people seem determined to challenge our efforts, but we are not going to let them prevail. He looked straight at Molly. Are we? She shook her head. Molly still couldn't get herself to open her mouth and tell Bakar everything was going to be okay. Maybe because she wasn't sure it was. One thing still had Molly confused. If Bakar's uncle is the leader of what's left of the Covenant, what does that have to do with the servants of the abiding truth? Lucy put a hand on Bakar's shoulder. He didn't pull away. She said, On the feed from the hangar, we spotted one Sangheili watching you distract the animal. Director Mendez handed her his slate, and she thumbed it on and held it up before them. From his armor and his complexion, we believe he's the new leader of the Servants of the Abiding Truth, better known as the Pale Blade. The image on the slate showed a Sangheili warrior dressed in a suit of blue-white armor. He carried an energy blade with him, holstered at his side. He cocked his head at something off to one side of the camera and began to visibly seethe with rage. He seems to know you. Lucy froze the image and zoomed in on the warrior's face. We were wondering if you might recognize him, too. Bakar cringed as if he'd been stabbed. You think you know who that was? Asked Director Mendez. Bakar straightened up and nodded. That is my brother, Dural Mdama. I have not seen him since our mother died. She had gone looking for Jewel more than 5 years ago and was on one of the servants' ships during a battle with the Arbiter when it was shot down. Tom gave Bakar an approving nod. That's him, then. The Pale Blade. That matches up with our intel. Oni believes he's been working with the servants for the past few years, probably since your mother died, and that he's been preparing for something big. It looks like they've finally made their move. To Onyx, unfortunately. Bakar looked as if he wanted to pass out. Molly's frustration with him suddenly shifted. She now felt sorry for him. She'd imagined what it might be like for her if Grace had suddenly turned up. How much joy that would have brought her. It should have been that way for Bakar, but it wasn't. His brother was the head of a violent terrorist sect, and had somehow broken into the most secure location in the galaxy. Molly couldn't imagine anything much more traumatic than that. We should tell him the truth, Lucy said. The two men looked reluctant, but she pressed hard. All of it. Tom stepped back for her. Be my guest. Lucy stood squarely before Bakar and took a breath before she began. We have it on good authority that Jewel Mdama isn't simply your uncle. He is, in fact, your biological father. Molly had thought she couldn't feel any worse for Bakar, but that soul-crushing bit of news was too much, even for her. It seemed as though fate had stuck a knife in Bakar's chest and started twisting. The young Sangheili sat back, astonished in part, but also evidently willing to accept whatever the truth might be. How do you know this? Oni operatives were in contact with Avu Medtelkem, once the former leader of the Servants of the Abiding Truth, for years. It seems Jewel knew the identities of his children, and at one time mentioned it to Telkem. After Jewel went off the grid, Telkem took the boy in, which is presumably how Dural eventually managed to find himself in charge of the servants. I had wondered about that. It would explain much, like why my mother pursued Jewel, even into the battles which took her life. That's not your fault, though, Gadam said. You can't control who your parents are. Bakar shook off the attempt to make him feel better. It does not matter if he is my uncle or my father, I am done with him either way. I have not seen him since my mother died. When I heard of his attempt to revive the Covenant, I knew what he had sacrificed, and I could never stomach that. He has been dead to me for years.
But why are the servants here? Molly asked. Why now?
The why is easy, Director Mendez said. Every enemy faction in the galaxy would love to get their hooks into Onyx. Some of the tech here could be used as a doomsday weapon capable of obliterating entire worlds. The significance of what's hidden on this world has implications for the safety of the entire galaxy. This sphere is exactly that important.
Kareem paled at that. Really?
The Forerunners, Mendez said, unflinching. They built the Halo Array to wipe the galaxy completely clean of all intelligent life. Planet-crushing weapons were probably what they made in their spare time. Every bit of their technology here is a double-edged sword. Not only can humanity and its allies benefit from it, but if others gain access to it first, the chances of survival of all of our kinds plummets significantly.
In any case, Lucy said,
the real question isn't why they're here, but how.
Kareem swallowed.
This is supposedly the most secure facility in the galaxy, right?
It's also one of the largest, Molly said.
There might be more than one entrance into the place. They could slip in and out of here before anyone even noticed, using a back door everyone thought was closed or didn't even realize existed.
We have it completely locked down against that, Lucy said, as well as can be done.
That includes round-the-clock satellite surveillance to alert us of any ships entering the system, much less getting near Onyx itself.
The bottom line is that we don't know how they got in, or how they're moving around so easily from portal to portal, said Director Mendez.
We've got some leads, and we're going to send teams out to investigate. But until we get hard evidence, it's all speculation at this point. Speculation you children don't need to be bothered by.
Then do we at least know why they've come here now? Molly asked.
This place has been occupied by humans for a while. Seems like a strange coincidence for this to be happening now, when there's a larger presence of UNSC forces than ever before.
It may have had something to do with Telcam's death, Lucy said. He was taken out a few months back on a Spartan op. Whoever took over the servants, it looks like Dural, may have decided now was the time to act.
But how would the servants even know about Onyx? Molly asked. Isn't even the existence of this place top secret?
Jewel N'Dama and Avu Med Telcam worked together at one point. And regrettably,
N'Dama knows about Onyx and a number of its specifics, Director Mendez said.
He has for years.
As to how he knows that,
I'm afraid that's classified as well.
So we don't get to know? Molly gestured to herself and the three others. We're here, living inside something that's been classified. Who would we tell?
Director Mendez favored her with the oddest little smile. You work your way up to taking over as the Commander-in-Chief of ONI, and you can read all the classified files you want, Ms. Patel. Meanwhile, you're going to head home and let your parents take care of you for a while. Risking your lives means that you've earned a day off. We've called in everyone from the field as a security precaution. Given the breach, we're going to put the entire city on mandatory lockdown for the time being, Lucy said. We'll be personally escorting you to make sure you get home safely.
Think of it as a reward for your heroism today, Tom said.
Don't encourage them, Director Mendez said.
What? Like you did with us? Tom smiled.
The director did not see the humor in the comment.
Exactly. Bakar waited for Kasha to finish with her duties while the other three departed.
Gadam gave the Sangheili a big hug, and Kareem bumped fists with him. Molly only gave him an understanding nod, which he returned. Molly, Kareem, and Gadam got to ride in the rear bed of a warthog, with the Spartans in the front. Molly had only seen such vehicles on vids, and she couldn't believe she was in